Hey, hi, welcome to the May 8th use case realization call. today we're going to be Jimmy is going to be giving a presentation on the ANEI's model browser in Sparky. And I had just started the meeting talking about some of the other topics. While we waited for people to gather. Kyung. K-E-O-N-G. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay, so one of the things that we're, as I mentioned before, I started putting the other table of a flow of presentations. I'll probably eventually put some of the key presentations down. I'm not sure I'm going to put all of these down, but I was keeping it in a table in the use case realization called PowerPoint slides. But I realized it's probably more useful in the wiki, so. started creating a wiki for it and who was giving the presentation, where the recording can be found or slides can be found, and what it is and the date it was given. So again, today Jimmy will be presenting on the ANA's developer model browser and Sparky, the runtime browser. so we started talking about probably one of the more important topics or the developments that happened in the past week. So given that R5 is a maintenance release, one of the things for use cases is that we're going to go back and for all of our use cases and add some more business driver imperative sections. and so I added the 7 parts of a business plan, the executive summary, the business impact or business description, the market analysis, funding requirements, financial impacts, organizational management, sales strategies. I figure most of these use cases probably don't have the 6th and 7th point because they're kind of related to all of the whole business, all of ONAP itself. But so I was just with Zoo drafting, as we were waiting for people to join, drafting the pre-onboarding and onboarding one. So the business impact is a business imperative because it's vital because ONAP needs to be able to load PNF artifacts, which define how messages and the PNF behaves, the descriptors. Okay. Oops. Should have to be done if in this case we're in. All right. Zoo, how does this look to you?
It looks good. I like your text.
Okay, and of course feel free to edit whatever you want if you have some more thoughts, you know, just go to the page, yeah. And you can update it. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so I think the idea is, you know, each of the use cases, and I just did it for one, but you know, everybody needs to go back and do theirs. Give some kind of just one sentence or maybe one or two sentence description of what the use case is. Why it's important to businesses. What markets, if it's a, there's a specific market you apply to. So for example, like the BBS use case applies just to wireline markets, whereas this applies to, you know, all potential markets that would use PNFs. Okay, and then basically why it's important from a financial standpoint. Okay. All right. And maybe here we can say there's no special organization or sales strategy over and on top of ONAP's normal business deployment. Maybe I can write some standard wording for that. Okay. Any comments from anybody? Does this look okay to people? Okay. So that was one topic I really wanted to make sure that we covered. So see example from PNF PNP and PNF pre-onboarding, onboarding. All right, and I wanted to give the bulk of the time to Jimmy to give us a demonstration of the demo of the model browser. Jimmy, are you there? Jimmy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I'll stop sharing and you can share.
Okay. Okay, let me just sort of level set what this is that we're going to look at today. First of all, I did have a Sparky environment that was working, and it broke, my VM broke. So I cannot present a live demo of that today. And probably a better person to do that might be, I think Arul's gone, but maybe Francis from the ANI team. Might be a better person to do it anyway, because they understand it and know the features more. So I'll take an action item to set up that demo and get the right person to do that. Maybe on next week's call. Does that sound okay, Ben?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. So to sort of level set where we're at, what I'm going to demo today. This is sort of a complimentary view to what Pavel from the ANI team presented last week with his visualization of the ANI schema. One of the things that we found, is that there's not a lot of visibility into what's actually running in the ANI data model. So the modeling subcommittee is publishing papyrus models with information, their information model and their data model. And those are sort of these UML representations of, what actually ONAP is delivering. And the request from the modeling subcommittee was to provide sort of a reverse engineered UML based on the existing runtime model in ANI. So it's sort of like the modeling subcommittee is looking at it from the theoretical, here's how it ought to be, or, you know, sort of the clean room, this is what the model is, and then there's somewhat of a gulf between that and what actually is in ANEI. And so the request was to create tooling around providing views into the ANEI data model with eventually getting back to a reverse engineered UML of the ANEI runtime model. Now, what we found was, and Michaela, and I can't remember the other woman's name, I think from either Nokia or Ericsson, had already done some reverse engineering and taken the ANEI data model, or at least the OXM schema from ANEI, and produced a UML document.
Oh, right? That was Michaela Bekova.
Yeah, Michaela, and then but the person that actually did the work, I can't remember her name. But in any case, I think we were supposed to get together in the next week or so. She had gone on a vacation, so we haven't touched base again. But the idea is that and what they did was produce a UML that would show all the relationships between all the objects in the OXM. And they ran into a similar problem to what Pavel showed us last week, right? Which is that, like, if you take the relationship list object, right? Or the relationship list Java type from the OXM, you end up with connections to everything else, right? It becomes sort of a mess, and you end up with, you know, such a huge diagram that it's too much to eat all in one bite, right? That you just can't see it and visualize it in a way that from that level, it just is too big with too much stuff to actually be particularly useful. So, you know, I think that Pavel's attempt, right, or Pavel's work on GraphGraph, the ANEI subsystem called GraphGraph, is allowing users to try, it's sort of a step towards the visualization, which allows a user to have that, you know, 10,000 foot view, which again becomes an eye chart that you can't really even read. But by allowing users to sort of click into, you know, get tighter and tighter on the things that they're interested in, it starts to become more useful. So in the ANEI team, what we've been discussing is a way to present the data and what the model browser, what I'm going to show you here, is intended to do is give you a view of the schema and then the edge rules, the vertex types that are in the graph, which are modeled as Java types in OXM, to give you a mapping that allows you to look at it without having to see all the ways that everything can be connected all together, right? And that's the challenge of ANEI, because, you know, we have, you know, like 15,000 plus endpoints, right? And to an application developer, that might be interesting. But when you try to map 15,000 things onto one screen, it becomes a little bit too much to look at, right? So this is, again, similar to what Pavel showed last week, but it's done in a way that shows the containment, shows the edges, and really gives you a ability to dig into the properties that are assigned on each Java type. So I'll go ahead and share. So this is the default view, and this allows you to pick schema versions all the way back to V11. So V11 is the Amsterdam version of ANEI. V13 was Beijing. V14 is Casablanca, and then V16 is Dublin. So in between, you'll notice that there is a V12 and a V15, right? These were e-comp releases. The e-comp system is still continuing to contribute, you know, their changes back into ONAP, but their release cadence is not exactly aligned. So since there are more e-comp releases per year than ONAP releases, you'll notice that we have multiple versions, and we keep them in the ONAP system, you know, for compatibility's sake. So I can go back in time and see what the APIs used to be, and I can also choose here from the list. I can look at a particular type. So if I want to look at a complex, right? I pick it, it will parse the schema and show me that this is a collection of physical locations that can house cloud regions, right? And you'll be able to get details on each attribute, sort of what it does in the system. You can see the types, and then what attributes are applied to each. Key means, is that the key for this Java type? Is it indexed, searchable, and required, right? So essentially it's giving you all the information that's stored in that OXM schema, and then it shows you the containment, right? So it's showing you that CTAG pools are a child of the complex, and you'll see them also over here on the left. And this represents the edges. So one of the things that when I talked to Michaela, right, when they looked at the existing UML, is that they hadn't taken into account the edge rules. So understanding ANAI, the schema itself, right, like this stuff, the attributes that belong to an object, you know, whether it's searchable, index, required, this kind of stuff, this is really not the entire picture, right? And if you have these contained objects, that's only part of the story, right? Because the other part is, you know, we're defining the vertex. That's significantly important. But how the vertexes relate to each other is really the thing that makes ANAI what it is, right? It is a graph database, which is really good at doing things like showing you what's connected to what, right? So in leveraging the strengths of ANAI, I think modelers need to understand not just what types of vertexes are available and maybe how they are hierarchically contained within each other, but there's also this piece which is what we call cousin edges, right, which are links between vertexes that can be traversed, right, to show you, you know, complex topologies. That if you just do analysis on the schema, right, the OXM schema that ANAI uses, you're missing that piece. And that was, you know, sort of the thing that I, when I talked to Michaela and her team, that was sort of a piece that they were missing and was sort of missing from the UML definition of the ANAI data model, right, which was, you know, capturing this stuff, but missing the stuff on the left and the right. So
just a quick question. The contained objects are always at the bottom of the set of attributes, and how can you tell they're contained objects? Just that they're in purple underscore, or I mean, obviously a string is a string, but
yeah, based on their type, right? Because it refers to another type that is, so ANAI has this sort of plural singular thing where the CTAG pool, right, is the actual object. So if you look over here at the edge, And if I hover over that, it will tell you information about that edge. But you'll notice that there's this containment thing, right? So it goes CTag pools, and that's broken. If I take CTag pools, it will then tell me that a CTag pool is the child of that, right? So it has this, the way that the URIs are constructed is this plural singular object, plural singular object, right? So it goes CTag pools slash CTag pool, and then the actual item. I think this is not common in a lot of REST APIs, but that's the way ANI does it. So if you see a type of that is inventory.ai.onap.org, that is indicating that it is a contained object within the same schema. Did that answer your question, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. But then not all the things on the left side are, so some of the things are on the left side, the two edges are contained, or are they all contained? You have CTag pools, I see that on the left.
Yeah.
And
so relationship list isn't really a thing. Let me pick a different one that might give us, so let's choose generic VNF. So generic VNF has a few of these, right? Entitlements, L interfaces, lag interfaces, licenses, right? So they're up here, lag interface, entitlement.
I guess I'm trying to ask, is there a one-to-one correspondence between all of the things in the bottom contained and the things on the left you would expect, or?
It's not one-to-one. It could be. It's potentially one-to-one. So if a type didn't have any cousin edges, then that would be true, right? So in this case, there would be a representation of each of these edges, right? These are parent-child edges. So entitlements, L interfaces, lag, licenses, and VF modules. All of these are sort of hierarchically contained under the generic VNF. But you'll notice that there are many others that are not in that list, right? And that's sort of how you tell that it's not, that it's a cousin edge, right? So if you look at the edge rule, right? It's saying, and this is particularly easy to read, and I think that one of the things that we need to do, you know, in this interface, or maybe in GraphGraph, is, you know, sort of explain what these things mean. In this case, right, it says contains other V. So this is showing that this edge is a type where it is contained under the generic VNF, right? And if I look at one that isn't in the list, right, so device is one of those, you'll notice that the contains other V flag is set to none. So it is basically combining the schema with its hierarchical representation of objects with the edge rules, which the edge rules are a superset of the contained objects and what we call cousin edges, right? They are, they don't depend on one another. So in this case, the generic VNF has dependencies, or the entitlement depends on the generic VNF. So you can't add one, or an entitlement doesn't exist in this context, unless it's contained under a generic VNF. But, you know, a device could exist separately from the generic VNF. And what you're doing when you create that edge, right, is essentially linking the generic VNF to the device.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think if you're making some updates to this, similar comments to what I gave to Pavel, I'd put the label here on the edges, because I think that's useful to bubble up to the surface, and then maybe also separate the tree edges and the cousin edges into two different groups.
So yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it'd probably be easier to see if on the left you grouped all the cousinages together and all the direct, direct children edges.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think I'll do that.
Is there a same sort of thing on the right as well? There's two different kinds of outgoing edges, or?
Yeah, so basically what I did was categorize them according to the direction on the edge roll, right? So in this case, the direction is out, and I think we're always doing outs. So if the edge goes toward the object, so one of the things that the ANI interface doesn't really care so much about the direction of the edge. Like if you do a custom query with an ANI, where you essentially like you start with, let's say your start node on the custom query is the generic VNF, and then you want to sort of drill into, traverse across multiple edges. It doesn't care what the direction is. So basically, custom query, you just say, I want to start at the generic VNF, and then I want to go to, VF module, right? And then from there, I want to go to the model ver, and then from there, I want to see, a PNF, right? And you can see that you can move around the graph really easily, but it doesn't care about what the direction of the edge is, right? It is simply, do those things have an edge between, or do those vertexes, are they connected by any kind of an edge? And then the custom query will traverse it. So I separate them out, right, as to and from, just because that's how, they're being tracked that way. But in terms of like practical use of it, there isn't really like rules around, when you're doing the traversal, that it must be an edge of a specific type.
So Jimmy, question. So the one you mentioned, when you, let's say your modeling come to the ANI, and you have the schema in mind, right? Say you traverse from VNF, PNF to VF module, and each have edge relationship with I interface. So you can you show us graphically, or we have to know the schema first?
Like so
the hierarchy.
So like last week, I think Pavel showed in GraphGraph how there's, and Pavel, I'm not sure where that functionality is, right? If we've gotten to the point there, but I think that the GraphGraph visualization tool, right, is I think getting to what you would want there, right? Which is it will show you all the possible ways to connect from one node to the other type. So you don't. Mm-hmm. So in mine, you have to like drill through and find it, right? Whereas I think with Pavel's, it will tell you, here are all the ways to get from, P server to generic VNF. Right, Pavel?
Yes, that's correct. So basically, for example, you want to know how V server and P server are connected. So you basically choose the source node or source entity and a destination entity, and it shows you all the paths which are viable in the schema. And then basically it will visualize all these paths, so you can have a look how the model is connected and what are the edge rules and what are the parent-child relationships between the entities.
So in other words, you have this function in this GUI to be showing on the, you just mentioned the old edge, V server, P server, and the node information in this GUI, right? I just want to confirm this. Okay.
Yeah, but for example, the tool that Jimmy is showing now does a better job of displaying all the properties, because GraphGraph doesn't go so deep in properties and what are the types and so on. So it just shows you the structure and and just the basic properties of all the entities.
Okay.
So one of the things, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Ben.
I was just going to say, I can see how how they can complement each other, because one uses most of the visual field of the screen to show essentially the relationships of the nodes, whereas this goes into a lot more detail about the actual properties within any particular node. And there's only so much screen space, so one is they're emphasizing different but complementary things.
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of what we were talking about, on the ANI call, and Pavel and I are going to sit down and look at ways that potentially we could sort of integrate these views, because we think that they are, again, like Ben said, I think they're complementary, and it really, might be useful to be able to drill into this view in certain contexts, but then, be able to flip back into, the graphical representation, when you want to see sort of a higher view. So we're looking at ways to sort of integrate the views so that we could have both, right, in a usable, seamless environment that would give people both the sort of this text-based description of the objects with their properties, as well as sort of where that object fits within the context of the larger system.
So I also had a question. Can you say a little bit more about for the and I know some of the answers, but I think it would be useful just to have them recording, like the key, the index, the search, the requirements, that there's only one and only one key.
That's not true.
No? Oh.
Not true in all cases. So like, for example, here's Cloud Region, and you'll see that it's a multi-part key, Cloud Owner and Cloud Region ID. So, and if you look at the way that it's defined in the schema, these may actually be out of order, because I'm doing them by alphabetical order. To create the URI, I think you do cloud, the cloud owner first.
Cloud owner first, yeah.
Right, but it basically it's just an accident of the fact that they're in the same that they are in alphabetical order.
Is that lexical by the OXM file? Because I don't think there's any explicit ordering ID or numbering that creates that structure.
Well, it's the ordering in the OXM file that determines which is the first part of the key.
Yeah.
But again, this really isn't an API description, right? It's more like object description. So to your point, there are cases where multiple attributes can be the key on an object.
So I guess I was trying to say, maybe you can say some more words about the key, index, search, those columns and what they mean.
Sure. So the key is the field or fields that will construct, that the URI is constructed from. So like a URI here would look like, AAI/V16/cloud infrastructure/cloud regions/cloud region, and then the cloud owner, and then the cloud region ID as tokens on the URI. That is the unique identifier within the graph. This was a design decision that was very early in ANI. Some people have wondered if maybe it would have made more sense to use a UUID for each object. And I think that there may be, some push in that direction in the future. But for now, that URI is the unique identifier for the object within the graph. Indexed means that in the Janus graph, that attribute is searchable. And indexed.
That's not a restriction though, is it, Jimmy? Because you can put any like complex name, for example, as part of a URL query. It just won't be quick, perhaps.
Right. So, we don't restrict on, you can search on any attribute, I think, but there is a field called searchable.
I think when it's indexed, yes, then it's indexed in Elasticsearch.
Searchable indexed in Elasticsearch?
Yeah, so it's faster.
Searchable is indexed in Elastic, right, which is a separate system. Indexed is it's indexed in Janus graph. And then required means that you have to supply that attribute when you do a put on the object.
Although that's also not true if there's a default, because it will fill the default value. It's a bit misleading, that required flag.
Right, so I think these are two examples, right, where these are Booleans. The default is, it's not required, but it's gonna get set to false by default?
I think it's specified in the OXM. I'm not sure if there is a default, but I think all the Booleans I've seen actually specify a default value.
Got it, okay.
Actually, it would be, we see it from the UI perspective, it would be good to have a tooltip above the column, so the key index, and when you would hover with the mouse, it would list the description, what it means.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And I think, to Kyung's point, that default value is a field, right, within the schema that could be easily parsed out. And could also be included here. I think that might help to alleviate the confusion, right, that you raised, Kyung, where you don't know if it's actually required. It may or may not be.
So if something uses a default value, are you saying it could have a blank there but still be required, or the vice versa?
So if you fail to pass the attribute, the ANI system will populate it with the default value. So it's required in the sense that the graph needs to have it, but it's not necessarily required that the user has to supply it on the put or the patch.
I see. And what value does it use? How does it know what value to use?
It uses the value from the OXM file. So it's a like a XML property that's set on the attribute, so it's in the schema, and you know, I just didn't think to display it, but it's a good idea.
So does that mean that where does it get that value? Does a user put it?
Yeah, it's manual.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, it's defined by whoever does the schema update in ANI. So ANI's schema is really still maintained by hand. You know, there's talk about, you know, ingesting the schema from, like, you know, Tosca or having another source for it, which I think ultimately, you know, is a worthy goal, and hopefully, you know, we get there someday. But for now, you know, the fields and the descriptions, everything is manually edited in the ANI schema.
Jimmy, I was just thinking about that because there's a lot of internal stuff like private edges and other things which probably wouldn't be in SDC or in the Tosca.
Right. And there's part of the multi OXM initiative that we did, right? And I think that we did I think you were involved, right, when we did that CCVPN use case, and then we tried to overlay things, and then it broke because it wasn't set up correctly. That initiative was sort of in line with what you're describing, right? So that you could have, you know, ingest from multiple files, multiple sources. That way you could have like sort of a clean version that would come from somewhere, right? Whether it's SDC or Papyrus or whatever it is, right? You could ingest a clean version and then overlay, you know, updates that are specific to your runtime environment or those internal objects that SDC or Papyrus wouldn't ever know about, right?
Yep.
But, you know, I think that those private edges might be also interesting too, right? Because it's you know, something that even though you don't really see them right in the graph, you know, when you do a get, you can traverse them right by a custom query, right? So that might be interesting also to display on this page.
Yeah, and that was goes to my other item that I raised, is how to visualize the custom queries, which I think could be woven into this and GraphGraph.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, Pavel, did you have any thoughts on like how you do that?
Can you repeat the question?
So, Kyung just brought up the point of, you know, we have all these traversals, right, that are sort of pre-canned, and just level set for the larger team. I will bring up the notes about a custom query, because to me this is really powerful feature of ANAI, and you know, defining custom queries, right, allows you to do the kinds of traversals that I was talking about, right? Start here, go there, go to the next place. So I think there's a
link at the bottom which goes to another page.
This is it.
Jimmy, can you put this wiki link in the chat? I think that might be useful to include.
Sure, I'll copy this one. And this one. So this document shows all the possible ways to use them, right? So here's an example, right? So so a query called access service from service instance. So you start with a service subscription, and then it will fetch the customer forwarding path, configuration, UPC forwarder, all of these things that if you were to do it manually, you could see the relationship between them, right? You could do a get and then look at the relationship list, parse it, then go to the next, and so forth. Or you give it one query, it will fetch all of this data from the graph and give it back to you all in one big set, which would look like, you know, one of these various formats, right? So we have all of these custom queries, right, already defined, VNFs from pServer, VNFs from service instance, all of these different ways to query the graph. And, you know, again, this textual representation is interesting, but like, what if we had in GraphGraph something that could sort of do the traversal for you without actually having objects to traverse, but just show you what the traversal looks like in a graphical way? I think that's the question, Pavel.
Yeah, that could be done. So when the query, we would have the query, or we would just read the queries from somewhere, interpret them, and then display what they actually retrieve.
Yeah, there's a stored queries JSON file in Schema Service. I'm not sure if you can get it through the API, but Traversal uses it, so you know you have to parse the textual language that it's in, but it's clearly got names of classes and names of edges, you know, cousin edge, tree edge, things like that.
Yeah, then so that could be displayable. I think it wouldn't be a big issue.
Yeah. So, to me, that's another example of, you know, the kinds of things that ANI is capable of, but people might not realize it because it's kind of a difficult concept to get your head around, right? But if we had that visualization, I think that, you know, it would probably help with the adoption of using them, you know, on a regular basis. So that is in our, that is on our roadmap of things that we'd like to do to sort of give people, you know, more tooling around, you know, visualizing the model, not just the schema and the edges, but also ways that the API can be used to give you the data that you need from ANI. So, I mean, we're getting
closer. Sorry. I had also a question about the searchable. I noticed that it's not very often popular. Like most of it's always blank. Do you have to do something to make that? It's used in Elasticsearch to make searches faster, right? Do you do something to make that searchable, or is it just, how is that set, or how is that?
So it's in the schema, and you know, I'm wondering if I have a bug if it's not showing.
Yeah, so Ben, all of those columns there are properties in the XML. And since it's all manually edited, you just say yes, no, or add the item to the list.
Yeah, it's a
right. But I guess the point. I guess I was trying to ask. Maybe let me see if I can ask in a different way. So the search index, the search field, tells you if it's indexed in an Elasticsearch, which makes it faster, right? Which means that you've kind of done something to speed up the search.
No. So Elasticsearch is a separate service, and I believe what it's doing is parsing this file and then configuring the search engine to index those properties. And then the Sparky UI and other things can use the Elasticsearch API to do queries through that service rather than directly through the AAI resources. So the Elasticsearch then will have its own in-memory indexing or whatever structure it has.
So this field really tells you that you would like to add this to, you should add this to the indexing from that other parsing, the thing that parses it. Pay attention to this particular attribute, right? And do I understand correctly?
Well, Elastic is used by the Sparky UI. So I think it's fields that they want to do searches on, that they're allowing searches on in the Sparky UI. And I think, again, I'll have someone who can speak more to that next week or the week after, if we can get somebody from the team to give a demo. And they could probably answer those questions.
Okay.
And I discovered that I don't have a bug. It actually works. Here are two examples. Volume group name and volume group ID under volume group have searchable set to yes.
Yeah, I was just curious because I noticed it's very, very few of them are populated.
Yeah, there's not that many.
Yeah.
I think the server would have some. Yeah, so there's three here. I think it's really about driving the GUI, which the GUI presents sort of a limited view of ANI objects that are geared toward operational concerns. And they've really sort of focused on the things that are going to be the heaviest hitters for operations to be able to do their work. And again, I think that leads into the discussion around Sparky, which we can have at another time.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Well, Ben, thank you for allowing us to present here today.
Yeah. Thank you for presenting. That was very useful. That was very interesting.
You will, I'll find somebody to do Sparky too.
Okay. All right. Great. And show me screen. So Jimmy just... I took some screenshots of what you were doing and some notes. So, you know, you might upload it in and you can edit and see if you might find it useful for future presentations or to describe ANA to somebody. I also took some notes as you were talking about the ANA browser. I type it 60 words a minute so I can kind of capture what people are saying. So, you know, you can edit this. And the wiki, if you think there's anything incorrect here.
No, that's really great. And I just can't believe how much work you do, Ben.
Yeah, thanks. All right. Thank you, everybody. We've hit the end of our time. I'm going to stop.